Welcome, everyone. I'm Philip Bailey, WFPL's political editor, and I'm joined by my co-host and Marshall, staff writer at Leo Weekly. And this is the District 1 debate of the Louisville Metro Council. Let me explain the rules very simply. The candidates will not get an opening statement, but each candidate will receive time for closing remarks. Candidates have 2 minutes to answer, and their rivals are allowed a one-minute rebuttal. The debate will be in three sections: District 1 issues and questions that pertain just to the district, political issues, and of course, citywide issues, legislation that they may or may not vote on in the Metro Council. So let's get right at it. To my immediate right is Louisville Metro Councilwoman Attica Scott. Sitting next to her is Stephen Colston. He's a UofL mechanic, maintenance mechanic. To my left is Rosa Macklin. She's a small businesswoman in Louisville. And next to her is Janice Carter Miller. She's a substitute teacher at Jefferson County Public Schools. Oh, and also please silence your cell phones or anything of that nature. Anne?
All right. Well, our first question tonight has to do with the issue of housing. Data shows that nearly three-fourths of all Louisville Metro's subsidized housing units are clustered in 7 out of the 26 Metro Council districts, with District 1 being among those 7. The Metropolitan Housing Coalition, in its 2011 report, urged city lawmakers to change the land development code so that multifamily housing could be built in neighborhoods throughout Louisville, possibly even offering incentives to sweeten the deal for developers. What are your thoughts on this, especially given the fact that right now the land development code is under review?
Mr. Colston.
I'm sorry, can you take part of your time and read the question one more time?
Absolutely. So data shows that nearly three-fourths of all Louisville Metro's subsidized housing units are clustered in 7 out of the 26 Metro Council districts, with District 1 being among those 7. The Metropolitan Housing Coalition, in its 2011 report, urged city lawmakers to change the land development code so that more multifamily housing could be built in other neighborhoods all around Louisville. What are your thoughts on this, especially given the fact that the land development code is currently under review?
I think out in District 1, that would probably work. Not being real familiar with that ordinance itself, would probably work. We have a lot of area out in District 1 that we can use for housing. We have a lot of housing issues already in our district. But there's a lot of opportunity out in District 1. That being said, I'd like to see a lot of growth. I don't know that we've had a tremendous amount of growth out there with regards to housing, and I'd like to see District 1 start to grow. We have a lot of issues out there that I think is preventing it. We have some issues with pollution. We have some issues with industry. And, you know, once those things are addressed, I think we'll be a great district to have some more housing brought into the area.
Councilman Scott.
Yes, we definitely need to provide incentives and change our land development code to provide for multi-family housing. The Family Scholar House, as you all know, is opening up a facility in the Parkland neighborhood, and this is one primary example of where incentives would be vitally useful for an organization that provides services to single parents, both mothers and fathers, who are wanting to pursue their higher education and be productive members of our society. And so providing incentives for the Family Scholar House to be able to open the Parkland Family Scholar House would be a rich boon to District 1. And of course, providing affordable and quality multifamily housing is a need in our district.
Ms. Macklin?
What comes to mind for me is the Park Duval area, where they used that model as far as having multifamily homes and single-family dwellings. We also have the same thing going out on Cane Run Road, where they did the Coventry Arms. They are redeveloping the Box Elder area now to put up single-family dwellings. So I think that they have used the model in Park Duval and in other areas of the First District, and the incentives have worked. So I would agree with that.
Ms. Carter Miller?
Well, I don't know much about these different programs that they just mentioned, except I do know about the Park Duval and dealing with planned communities. the planned communities that are needed down in the southwestern part of the community of District 1. Like Mr. Colston said, there's plenty of space and area that would be an added plus to the makeup of the community. They have several neighborhoods already, such as Southern Farms and St. Denis, that are thriving communities, and I think multiple family homes that are planned out to add to the basic landscape of the community are well needed.
Now, we all know that the number on abandoned properties is pretty fluid in the city, but it's clear that a majority of those abandoned properties are in the West End. What ideas do you have? What strategies should the city adopt to curb that trend? We'll start with Ms. Macklin.
Well, first of all, we have to look at the state laws. Because of the state laws, you cannot really go in and take someone's property. But what I would consider doing and talking to the constituents in District 1 would be that if you have a property next door to you, being an investment property owner myself, I would suggest that you cut that lot and do as the city does, and that is put a lien on that property as you cut those lots. Then that would increase your property, keep your property value where it needs to be. And then I will also advocate being a little bit more aggressive with the adverse possession law, that bringing in and utilizing people in the community to maybe rehab it enough where somebody could come in and take possession of that property. I know it takes 15 years, but that I think that's the only way we can do it, seeing that the state law is in place.
Now, you mentioned the state law that doesn't allow that, but should we change state law to allow metro government to seize properties?
Well, when I talked, we did have someone to come in that talked about the state law, and they said it would be almost impossible to get that done. It's not that it couldn't be possible, but we're talking about rural communities and the entire state. So when you're talking about farmland, somebody might get a little bit upset you try to step over on their farmland.
Councilman Scott, you're the vice chair of the new ad hoc committee on vacant properties. I don't believe the council has talked at all about changing the state law. So given that, what is it that the city is trying to do, and what is it that you want the city to do to address this problem in West Louisville?
Well, the one piece of legislation that we did support this year was House Bill 62, which would require a deed in lieu of foreclosure, which basically means that instead of these homeowners, whether it be a bank or a corporation, holding on to the deeds in what's considered a pocket deed, they would have to file them so that we can find out more readily who owns the property and hold them accountable for maintaining the property and determining what they're going to use the property for. One of the issues that we've been talking about on the Vacant Property Committee is how do we develop communities neighborhood by neighborhood or block by block? Some ideas we've tossed around are to make it easier for community groups and neighborhood associations to get a hold of some of these properties. And if we need to demolish them, to turn that vacant space into community gardens or pocket parks, use them for some productive use in the neighborhoods.
Ms. Carter-Miller, we hear a lot about different community partnerships and groups, but it doesn't seem that the city is taking an aggressive stance as far as Southwest Louisville, West Louisville is concerned in seizing or trying to get back some of these properties or rehabilitate them. What ideas and policies did you have to address that problem?
This is still pertaining to the vacant properties,
yes,
right?
Ma'am.
As Ms. Scott just said, I too believe that the community organizations should have more power in targeting those homes and seeing what they can do as a group to go in and if not to take possession of, but at least to look at how they can deal with the upkeep or just cutting down the weeds or have some type of maintenance being going on to the area until it goes through the process, whatever that may be, to find out who owns it or when they can take possession or however long that will take, but that the community... because the other day when I was walking, I went into an area on Fortson Way, and there was a home that was there. And the lady says, well, this home has been here for 25 years, it looking just like it looked. And the weeds were up to the top of the windows. And there was a large, humongous tree. Now, if that tree falls on anything or anybody in that area, they're in big trouble. So the communities need to have a closer connection with the city in finding out how they can work together to either maintain those properties or get rid of them.
Mr. Colston, in all these answers, I'm not hearing any specific policy being recommended for Metro government to take on. What are your ideas?
Well, basically, we do have a problem, and I think one of the first areas we need to look at is we need to look at IPL. We need to either give them some strength or something like that, give them some teeth, because I'm out there talking to people all the time, and they're saying, you know, I call, nothing ever gets done. You know, we need to give them some teeth, and I'm not talking about, you know, your average person. You know, sometimes we have some senior citizens out there that may have a little trouble. I'm not talking about people like that. I'm talking about vacant property where the grass is 2 foot high, you know, and nothing is being done about it. IPL comes out and, you know, the people never hear back. I've called my council person. I've called IPL. Nothing is getting done. We need to give them a little teeth. We also need to look at maybe some kind of ordinance to where we can take these properties and, you know, attach a lien to them. You know, maybe this is a revenue source for the Metro. Maybe it is an area where somebody can start a business, you know. Let's give some people some teeth, you know. Go out and cut a vacant, you know, have the paperwork, have the guidelines there, you know, so they can go out, they can get a job done, they can get a neighborhood, they can attach a lien to a piece of property. And again, like I said, maybe that's a source of revenue for the Metro. Maybe that is a new job for somebody out there who hasn't had a job in forever. Those would be the areas that I'd look at to propose language to help those situations.
I want to add to Philip's question here. At a recent vacant and abandoned property summit, there was a lot of frustration expressed by residents of the West End area specifically, talking about that, you know, while the ad hoc committee is focused on changes to state law and, you know, possibly some city policy tweaks, all of that takes so much time, and a lot of people are just really tired of looking at neglected homes and, you know, having their property values go down. So what would you say to a lot of this frustration, even ones that you've already expressed here at the growing grass and the, you know, abandoned trees and all that? So what would you say to your constituents?
You know, what I'd have to look at with regards to that is not being familiar with specific state laws on this, okay? And I know, you know, federal laws, you know, take precedent over state probably over Metro, things like that. But there ought to be an avenue by which we can submit some language. Okay, it's not going to be done overnight, but I don't see it taking, you know, months or years to get this done. Let's find a way. We've got attorneys that work for the Metro. Let's talk to them. Let's quit talking about what we're going to do, and let's just do it. You know, there has to be an avenue. We have the resources to find it. Do it.
Councilman Scott, you're the incumbent. Why are we just doing it?
Because state legislation says that it takes us up to 7 years to actually acquire property, because we have to find out, one, if the property is owned by someone who is deceased, then there may be a family member who's actually heir to the property, and it takes time to find that individual. Two, there are often properties that are owned by banks and mortgage companies that are not even located in our state. And three, the issue is that there are some banks that are outside of the country that own the property and make it difficult for us to hold them accountable. So we need to change state legislation from 7 years to at least 3 years for us to be able to take over these properties and use them for some positive public purpose.
Ms. Macklin, is that a satisfactory answer?
Well, I already said that state law was keeping you from doing it. I am going to take a vigilante source move here, because my platform is on community being responsible for their community. And although the state law keeps you from doing the things that you can legally do, because you might not ever get title to a piece of property if you can't find the people, but at least we can make housing for folk to live in, and you don't get to take it with you anyway. So you can live in there, have housing, take care of the property, and keep the values of the property up in the neighborhoods. But this is going to take the neighborhood. It's not going to take state legislation or Metro legislation. It's going to take the people saying, I had enough. We're going to take control of our neighborhoods and take them back.
Now, not to get you wrong, but please clarify if I'm wrong here. Are you suggesting issues like squatting, people taking these homes themselves? And
You said squatting. No. What I'm talking about is adverse possession. And I guess you could call that squatting, but it's a cuter word. And not living in the homes and they're dilapidated, but living in the homes that we have used the people in the neighborhood to rehab those homes and provide a place for people to stay, and it keeps up the property value.
I do believe that the city could delve a little further into finding an amendment to some of those state laws to bring it closer to reality of what can be done, to take another look at the laws that are on the book instead of just saying, well, this is what it is and there's nothing we can do about it. I think that the city can do something about it. I actually remember when Mayor Fisher was running for office, that one of the things that he said about in his campaign was that those dilapidated homes, those boarded up homes, that those were homes that he wanted to acquire in order to sell for a dollar to different businesses. I think it's a wonderful idea, but I think that there can be something because we can find, ways to do a lot of other things. We need to find the ways to do the things that really need to be done.
Switching gears a little bit, obviously an issue that comes up oftentimes in District 1 is the issue of crime. Let me start with you, Ms. Carter-Biller, by asking point blank, does District 1 have a gang problem?
Yes, it has a gang problem, and much to my chagrin, I met with the Captain Christofek down in Division 2, and to find out, and I asked in that meeting about what the crimes were. The largest crimes were burglaries where they knock on the front door and they go around to the back and kick the door in, where they were watching people that were going off to work, and then they were going and burglarizing their homes. The gang situation, I said, well, how many? There was one gang in particular in the area of Cecil and Greenwood. And I said, so how many people are in this gang? They said that there were 20 people in this gang. I said, well, that sounds like 20 people that just need some jobs. So we need to find ways to get to those 20 people to give them jobs because they have held that community as hostages. Back in the day, I remember that 20 people would never have taken over a community.
Ms. Macklin, the issue of jobs has come up in the issue of this gang question. Is that really the answer?
You know, that would be the answer if we were talking about we were bringing folk in from out of town to be gangs. But these are what they would call, I think the movie and the Four Brothers called it, these are in-town shooters. And what we need to do is work in the community, and mamas need to give their sons up, are they daughters, whoever it's, are the aunties, the grandmothers, because these are children in our community. They're not outside our community. And if we start there with people taking responsibility for their neighborhoods and their communities and putting their children in check, then we would not have that problem. Now, on the second part of your question, yes, we do need jobs. And that's where that renovation and revitalization of housing would come into play. We have so many people that are so talented, retired people that would be glad to teach these young men a skill. But first, they mamas got to give them up.
Now, you're saying, as a follow-up question, but some of these gangs that I'm thinking about, I mean, I'm thinking of back in 2005, the Click Tight Gang, which committed crimes all the way from Parkway Place in West Louisville all the way through parts of Indian Hills. This gang happened to be led by a 17-year-old. The problem didn't appear to be that he had family issues. He was just a hardened criminal. I mean, some of these questions some of these gangs are facing aren't really ones of economics or parental guidance. These people are just straight-up criminals.
Now, how did you come up with who decided that they were straight up criminals? I'm a little bit confused about.
So your argument is that they can be rehabilitated just through an economic sort of initiative.
I think that they can be rehabilitated if we start with them young. See, we have let the school system fail. The parents have failed. The school system have failed. The churches have failed. And now we got a problem. I don't think that anybody comes in here a hardened criminal. But with the right circumstances, then they can become whatever you want them to become.
Councilman Scott, the issue oftentimes when we talk about crime in West Louisville, there's the Weed and Seed program. Are you supportive of that program, number one, and has it been successful?
Well, the Weed and Seed program has been mostly used in Council District 5. And from what I've seen in Council District 5, it's had its ups and downs, its ebbs and flows. There are other alternatives that we can look at that may be just as successful, if not more successful. We need to have some quality out-of-school and after-school programs for our young people, which in District 1, there's a void. They don't exist. And we need to make sure that when we talk about jobs, we have job training in the neighborhoods instead of expecting folks to get on TARC, which is about to cut its routes and increase its fares to get to job training, have it right there in the neighborhood where it's much more accessible for people, and then have job placement opportunities. Because if you're trained for a job, but then there is no placement opportunity for you, then we've set you up for failure.
Mr. Colston, when the issue of gangs came up earlier this year, Councilman David James proposed that the new police chief, Chief Conrad, should reinstitute the gang unit. Do you support the idea of recreating that unit?
You know, I've heard of the one gang that was mentioned here recently, and I'm not so sure that the problem is all gang-related. You know, sometimes going throughout the district, you know, sometimes we just have a bunch of kids that are out and, you know, they have nothing to do. They're roaming the streets. You know, they're going to a big problem outside of our district is a movie theater. They're going out there and they're just causing havoc for everybody. From what I hear, the police can't do anything to these kids, I'm assuming because of their age or because there's very little, you know, with those kids. We need to get those kids involved. Those kids, you know, when I was growing up, I had what I called the fear of dad, you know, and when dad spoke, I listened. These kids have no fear because there's no authority for them to listen to. There's no authority to guide these people. You know, these aren't bad kids, okay? These are kids that just need to be involved with something. You know, the problem is we as adults are not addressing that issue. We need to address that issue. And then I think that, you know, once they get involved, I think everything starts to get better.
Can I add to that?
Sure.
I think one of the things about, I don't think our children are, they are raised to be gang members, number one. I think every parent that raises a child does not raise their child to be a potential gang member. There is a deficiency or a lack within that home. Sometimes it's the lack of a father or two parents, and sometimes they're in single parent households, especially with just the woman, and no role model for the young men. And also not having, for instance, the Boys and Girls Clubs open to provide safe havens. It kind of goes under, I just wanted to say, under my mantra of that we need to plan to repair our community for ownership. We need to take ownership of our children's behavior. We need to take ownership of our neighborhoods as far as what we need. We need to protect our seniors, and we need to kind of do a cross-generational situation with our seniors and our youth, because the guidance, the yes ma'am, the yes sir is gone, the respect isn't there anymore, and you're right, there is no fear factor. And teaching in Jefferson County Public Schools, they have no, the teachers can't teach them because they're afraid of them.
I can't tell you how many times, I'm sorry, Mr. Bailey, how many times I've gone to neighborhoods and people say, we never see the police. They never come down. That needs to change.
I've talked to a few teenagers in the Parkland area who say the loss of the Parkland Boys and Girls Club has been a great loss, that's really been a great loss to them, and they've had to find some alternative ways to entertain themselves. Do you think that has been a great loss in the community, and do you have any plans to fill that void?
Is that to me?
Who do we want to start with? Sure, go ahead. Please go ahead.
Okay. I do have plans. I used to be a director of a Boys and Girls Club when I was living out of Louisville. And for me, not having a Boys and Girls Club is vital. It's a safe haven. It's also a place where you can nurture our children with some educational programs to go along with the recreational programs. But it's a place where parents know that after school, this is where my children will be. This is where they will be supervised, and this is where they know basically that they should be safe. I've spoken with the president and CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Kentuckiana, and I've been discussing with her. I know that there's a church that's actually trying to purchase the Boys and Girls Club. But until that happens, there is another facility in the community called Trinity Family Life. Most people don't know that it exists, and they have programs from kindergarten to 21 years of age and job preparation. So having those programs in the community, because I went to those programs growing up, and they were vital in my life.
So your plan would be to partner with the Trinity?
It would be to partner with the Boys and Girls Club to see if they can, because when Salvation Army closed the doors to the Boys and Girls Clubs, left a void. It didn't give enough time for any of the community to get involved to either take over the leases or to purchase the facilities. And Boys and Girls Club of Kentuckiana came in. They reopened Newburgh, and now the only reason that Parkland's not reopened, they've got a big sinkhole in it. They've got major repairs that need to be done. So as all the faith-based institutions and different organizations need to come together to get that center open.
Ms. Mecklen?
Again, because we are not engaged, and that's the people in the community, things like this happen. This didn't happen overnight. We saw it coming, but we did not engage. We already knew that our kids didn't have a place to go if something closed down. We are not involved. That's the importance of people being involved in the community. So, yes, I would work with anybody that wants to open up the Parkland Boys and Girls Club or any other club for kids to go to. I would love for the churches to open up their family life centers, that folk would volunteer to meet with kids after school, do after school programs. It's going to take more than the Portland Boys and Girls Club. It's going to take these churches, and we got 1 million churches in District 1, and they will need to step up to the plate.
Ms. Scott?
Well, the Salvation Army, of course, needs to be called into question by the city, period, because we know that they closed the Boys and Girls Club, including Parkland. And we also know that they failed to come through on their promise to do something with the Croc Center property in Southwest Louisville off of Cane Run Road. So first of all, we need to call the Salvation Army into question. And then secondly, we know that there are a few groups that are actually looking at purchasing the Parkland Boys and Girls Club and reopen it with some strong youth programs. And I support that because we need the facility, whatever it will end up being and whosever hands it ends up being in, we need it there in the Parkland neighborhood because there is absolutely little to no activity for the young folks in the area.
Mr. Colston.
And I'm going to agree with Attica in that the Salvation Army needs to be looked at for multiple reasons. That being said, churches, yes. Community centers, yes. Government centers, yes. Libraries, yes. All these places have meeting rooms, okay? And a lot of times these meeting rooms aren't used. All we need to do is get a group of people together, senior adults, and you know, staff these things, make everybody aware of, you know, this is going to be open on this day. We have bus transportation, you know, we have all kinds of means to get throughout the city anywhere we want to get to, you know. We just need to start doing it, you know, quit talking about it. You know, when we were out at the Cane Run Business Association, they were talking about out there at that church, you know, years ago, they had a little building. and it was staffed with seniors, you know. And what a great opportunity, you know, to put some seniors with some youth, you know. It's going to be nice for the seniors. It's going to be educational for the youth, you know. Man, wouldn't it be great, you know, when I get to be 75 years old to know that I can go to the Cane Run Baptist Church down there, Lee's Lane Baptist Church down there, and there's going to be a nice young man or a nice young lady down there that would love to play a game of checkers with me. Quit talking about it. Let's just do it. Contact these centers, these libraries, and let's get it done.
Well, I did hear a lot of outrage on this panel in regards to the Parkland Boys and Girls Club. What I didn't hear was a price tag. How much is this going to cost, and who's going to pay for it, Mr. Colston?
You know, I don't know what's going on with, you know, I've heard a lot of conversation about what happened with the Croc Center and the Salvation Army. And, you know, then again, you know, everything is based on money, okay? And they don't have the funds, their budget's being cut. You know, I don't know that it has to be something as big as a Salvation Army doing this. It's just as simple as finding a location, staffing a location, you know, and then making people aware of it. You know, everybody wants to make everything about money, and it doesn't have to be that hard.
Councilman Scott, I'll ask more specifically, how much is this going to cost? Who's going to pay for it?
Well, there are, of course, to my knowledge, three entities that are looking at purchasing the old Parkland Boys and Girls Club, and they are working with the Salvation Army on the price tag for that property. So that's on them to negotiate. At the end of the day, when they do make the purchase and are in the process of renovating the facility, there is the city's responsibility to step in and provide some funding where they can. But they also need to do a basic, you know, old school capital campaign and get funding from the community, because it's also going to be ours to participate in and to support. And then, of course, there are a number of foundation grants that exist that would help support good youth programs.
Before we move on, Ms. Macklin or Ms. Carter-Miller, either one of you.
What I'd like to say is when the Parkland Community Center Boys and Girls Club closed, my understanding that it cost $350,000 to run a Boys and Girls program for a year, and that they could have opened all the programs up for anywhere between $1.5 million. Now, because the Parkland Boys and Girls Club was in such disarray because there was a roofing problem with leaks coming down onto the computers on the second floor, which caused another problem on with the leaks coming down to the first floor. And there were insurance monies, when you say check with what's going on with Salvation Army, there was insurance money to pay for that repair, and that those repairs have not been done. I don't know, but it looked like the roof had been done, but I'm not sure if that's roof work or not, but that's money that the Salvation Army already has to do those repairs to the roof of that center.
Ms. Macklin.
I'm going to go old school on you. It's 27,000 people in District 1. Let's do that times a dollar and then do it times 12. We have the economic power to make anything happen in that district that we want to happen. And we can look at that from how much money we've spent on campaigning. So there's money, but it's whether we want to give it up or not. So when we're looking at how much it's going to cost, I have no idea how much it's going to cost, but I know that our communities can survive if we would put our money into it.
Okay, we're going to switch topics here. Do you think the STAR program, which relies on businesses to accurately self-report their emissions, is adequate to protect District 1 residents? And Ms. Macklin, we'll start with you.
The EPA, okay, and the Air Board, they are the ones that kind of drive all of this. By working at DuPont for 34 years, I already know. The bottom line is, it's not whether the program is equipped to handle what goes on, what goes out into the community, is whether or not EPA or the Air Board wants to shut those plants down. And I don't think that they do. So that's why they fine them. And then they might tell them to make a deposit, and then we do scholarships, and we do different things because a lot of people work at those plants. Now it's some fail safes that we can put into place if we would do a better job of, I guess, collaborating with those plants, because they've been there for a long time. And really, if we stop using the same old people doing the same old things and really get into those plants and start figuring out what they're doing, educate ourselves on the chemicals that they have in there, then maybe these programs will work a little bit better. But it's kind of one hand washing the other. That's the way I see it.
Well, I think they're not good neighbors. And I think in order to have relationships within your community, everyone has to step up and be a good neighbor, whether they're your next-door neighbor or they're your corporate neighbor. And I live very close to Rubbertown. And the fumes and just the fear of explosions and alerts and things of that neighbor nature that they need, I don't think they've reached out to the community like they should or could, because there are several programs, just like we're talking about these Boys and Girls Clubs. One of those companies can take over a Boys and Girls Clubs. One of those companies can build another Boys and Girls Club in the Southwest. One of those companies can set up an urgent care center in the Southwest. One of those companies, they can take, you know, saying, okay, well, we give to the Boys and Girl Scouts and we give to the Red Cross and we ring the bell and come on now. You know, they've got to be, and the community has to be a lot more proactive in getting results from them. Because, you know, just to sit there and sit there year after year after year and see nothing going, I mean, it's lip service, but we need some action.
Mr. Colston?
The other day I was driving down the expressway and the Pirates Expressway, I believe it is, and I drove past the Bells Lane, Algonquin area, and in all honesty, I thought something died. That's something that died was probably the Morris Forman treatment plant there that MSD operates. And that you know, that's been a problem for years. You know, we have problems with industry. You know, things are happening all the time. It never gets reported. There's not a lot of transparency going on. And there's not many people in government that seem to want to do something about it. You know, the LG&E plant was fined some money for emitting some coal ash and stuff like that, and it went to the Air Pollution Control District, and I have absolutely no idea how that helped those residents in that neighborhood at that time. You know, fining a company a minuscule amount going to the Metro services didn't help those people. You know, what is the Metro going to do if they're not even going to police MSD and stop that? And that's been going on for years. You know, we need some hard hitters in there that's going to stand up and say, do it.
Councilman Scott, you're in government. What are we doing?
Well, what are we doing? So you asked originally, is the Strategic Toxic Air Reduction Program adequate? And actually this week, the Air Pollution Control Board will be meeting to give us an update on the program and some other initiatives that they're wanting to implement. The program is adequate in its limited ability. There are 19 chemical plants along the Rubbertown corridor, and to expect all 19 of them to report their own emissions is irresponsible on our part. What we need for the Air Pollution Control Board to do is actually go out and do its own air monitoring testing on a more regular basis so that they can see for themselves what the air quality is like along the Rubbertown corridor, which reaches from West Louisville to Southwest Louisville. And then, of course, we need to encourage the companies to use more natural gas and solar energy in the ways that they operate so that they can become more green.
Like I said, if any of you have questions about these District 1 issues, please just raise your card and Gabe will take them in the back. If not, sorry, we're going to have to move forward. We're running out of time a little bit here. Moving forward with the second set of issues in our second format of the debate, obviously, as many of you probably already know, District 1 is having a special election because its predecessor was removed from office. In the case of a vacancy, this is for all of you, in the case of a vacancy, state law mandates that the Metro Council appoint a replacement. Do you believe that practice should continue or that we should hold a special election immediately? I will start with Ms. Macklin.
You need to hold a special election. You want me to tell you why?
Please do.
Because we are all human. And it's not what you know, it's who you know. And we know that that works everywhere if we're being truthful about it. And I'm not saying that Councilwoman Scott is not a good councilwoman. I'm just saying that if I had been known, maybe I would have got it. But to be fair, we have to let the people elect the people they want to serve them.
Councilwoman Scott, let me ask you, this was an appointment process. You were obviously picked for that seat. Do you feel that we should have an appointment process or that we should hold a special election immediately?
I'm in favor of a special election, and I know that in reality it will take at least 30 days to happen because people have to have the opportunity to apply. They have to have the opportunity for the Board of Elections to review their status and to make sure that they're eligible to run. The Board of Elections has to, of course, staff the special election. There are 21 polling places in the district. You have to staff all of those polling places. And then, of course, you have to make sure that you create the ballot. So there has to be at least 30 days for the election to happen.
Now, not too long, almost really immediately after you were appointed, a colleague of yours, Councilwoman Mary Woolridge, she made the allegation that you were handpicked before the process even began. Did you hold any private meetings or have any private conversations with council members before the process started?
I actually called every single council member because that's what you're supposed to do when you're organizing.
But did you meet with anyone privately?
I did meet with a couple of them, not privately, but as a group.
Mr. Colston and Ms. Carter-Miller, do you think the appointment process was fair?
No, not at all.
No. I heard that the position was already filled before I'd even put my turn my application in. And I think that's unfair. That process was unfair. If that was going on, then why
put it? Not to put you on the spot, who told you that?
Oh, well, I'm not getting ready to divulge my sources. Why, but not
okay.
Me. No. I'm saying a little bird.
A little bird.
A little bird told me that. But I'm just saying, whether that happened or not, the fact that when Ms. Woolridge brought it up, I was pleased to know that it wasn't something that I was just hearing, that it seemed to be validated by her making the statement.
And the reason I asked that question is that I think everyone on the stage and in the audience can agree that District 1 has had some issues with transparency. And one of those issues, obviously, is when Councilwoman Woolridge brought this issue to the forefront. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to comment on how she knew that information beforehand. It seems to suggest that there was some backroom dealing, but no one who has this information on the backroom dealing wants to come forward. What? Isn't that the same problem we had under Councilwoman Green, where people didn't want to come forward with certain information?
Sure.
So you don't see the contradiction in that to say you don't want to tell who it is?
The council to deal with Dr. Judy Green and talk about transparency and then turn around and deal with no transparency, I think it was an oxymoron. You want one thing and you're doing the exact thing that you're saying that you don't want. You know, so there should be fairness. Just like I say, we need an even playing board. They need another way to deal with having to replace people.
Mr. Colston, you said that you didn't feel the appointment process was fair. Holding a special election will obviously cost money. Why don't you think that the appointment process was fair?
Well, basically, I must have talked to the same bird that Ms. Carter-Miller did, because I was told the same thing going in, and as has already been stated, you know, this is one of the major problems that the Metro Council has right now is backdoor dealings. You know, and that stuff has to be stopped. You know, they're a close-knit little family right there, and, you know, I think that has gone bad for the residents of the Metro, because they're basically making decisions based on a small group that's going to affect the whole Metro Council, you know, and Jim King sitting there. It's even odder that I believe that Miss Scott was a member of the redistricting. Yep. Just about the same time that the council thing was coming up, we lost some vital areas in our being Chickasaw Park. You know, the lines are crazy. You know, and then we have a vote. It's hard for me to believe that there wasn't deals going on that set up not only district lines, but Attica being put in office.
Councilwoman, let me ask you specifically, was there any sort of agreement or deal to put you on the seat beforehand, before the appointment process began?
There was no agreement or deal. Everyone had the opportunity to go to the open caucus meetings, which happened every Thursday at 4 o'clock. I went to the Republican caucus and the Democratic caucus. Anyone can go to those caucuses. They are open. And I need to know, Mr. Colston, what redistricting committee was I on?
I believe that I was told that you was part of the group that were setting the boundaries, the initial group.
No, the Metro Council members set the boundaries. I worked at Kentucky Jobs with Justice, a community group that was watching the process.
Mr. Colston, can I ask you who your source is on that?
The source on...
Who told you that the councilman was on a group that drew the district boundaries?
You know, in all honesty, I don't remember.
I think Ms. Macklin is dying to say something over here in regards to this.
You know, I get a little tired of people using the word transparency. There's no such thing in government and life, period. I mean, you can't say that we can be transparent when there's always a backdoor meeting. Always. And because everybody's agenda is not the same. Now, we might get in there and say that we're going to change it, but that's where the lobbyists come in. You know, it's a lot of things that go on that we won't know that goes on. And I wish folk would quit using the word transparency because it's not for real.
I'm going to move on here. Mayor Greg Fisher is fond of calling Louisville a compassionate city. Councilwoman Scott, you've questioned the mayor's use of that word relative to his proposed ban on protesters camping overnight in public green spaces, specifically Occupy Louisville. You told WFPL that compassionate doesn't mean creating barriers, but in essence that we listen and try to have some honest dialogue. Also, last month, the mayor refused to engage with another group of activists, Clout, on the issue of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. My question to all of you, and we'll start with Councilwoman Scott, is, you know, is this word compassion just a buzzword? And what exactly does it mean to be a compassionate city?
Well, yes, the word compassion is a buzzword. To be compassionate means that we go a lot deeper. We address issues of racism. We address issues of sexuality. We address issues of gender. We address issues of health disparities and economic disparities. And at this point, I don't see that with the Compassionate Louisville movement. And I do have to say that part of my concern with us saying that we're a compassionate city is that that means we're going to try to shut down dissent when it happens by saying, you know, we're compassionate, can't we all just get along and agree that whatever it is that we're doing is in the best interest of all Louisvillians. The reason why I questioned and challenged the mayor on the camping ban ordinance is because I felt like it was the opposite of what compassion should be about. And contrary to popular belief, we are not a family on Metro Council. My family members are people that I can argue with, and then the next day, you know, we just got to do what we got to do because we're family. Unfortunately, that does not happen on Metro Council. There are individuals who are upset that I would actually speak against the ordinance who they're upset with me because of that.
Mr. Colson?
You know, I'm in favor of everyone's First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and the right to peacefully assemble. It's about balancing everyone's amendment, First Amendment rights here. While I support their ideals and initiatives of Occupy Louisville, there has to be a balance with them exercising their rights and not infringing on everyone else's rights. You know, I understand, you know, Occupy Louisville was a big supporter of Attica, and I can understand her supporting them. You know, they are the 99% against the 1%. What I don't understand is while Attica supports the 99%, she's taking money from the 1%.
Mr. Colson, I'd like to ask you to explain, what do you mean by taking money from the 1%? You mean like a taxation policy?
No. What I'm talking about is Representative King and others holding fundraisers for Attica. It's all in the financial reports. She's made about $10,000, and this money appears to be coming from bankers, lawyers, doctors, business owners. You know, these are the people that I see being the 1%. You know. So I understand her wanting to support them. I don't understand her wanting to take the money from the 1%. You know.
Councilman Scott, a rebuttal?
How does Occupy Louisville support me?
Occupy Louisville supported you they were present last October, November when you were appointed. They were big people for you. I guess they were, you know, contacting their, and just for the record, I contacted every Metro Council person too prior to that. I sent every one of them an email saying, I'd love to meet with you. I am a candidate. You tell me when and where. And only one of them responded to me. And what he said was, I'm really sorry.
Are you saying the homeless folks who are part of Occupy
there? No, I'm saying.
Supporting me?
No. Supporting you?
You said that Occupy supported me.
I'm saying the people of Occupy Louisville, you know, are big supporters of yours.
How?
They were in major attendance October when the vote was cheering and every time your name was mentioned and when you were given the post, they went crazy.
Actually, those were labor union members because there was a major labor vote.
Right. Labor too.
Okay. Ms. Carter Miller? The initial question of a compassionate city. The initial question of, are we a compassionate city?
We can be. I don't think we are. And the word compassionate to me has to deal with understanding, care, and concern of your human, of human mankind. And I think that we're not there yet. There are a lot of issues in this city, from A to Z, the racism, the disparity, the way that we're set up to be more against each other than we are for each other. I'm hoping that Mayor Fisher really focuses in on how to bring the city together to become more compassionate, because I myself helped to help him get elected. So when I get a chance to talk to him, that's one of the things that I would like to see. I mean, we were talking about the 9th Street divide. Well, in District 1, we have a divide. It's Algonquin Parkway. You know, it's an imaginary boundary, but it exists. And I think that what I'd like to see happen is to bring the district as one together. Because just because you live on the other side of the street, we have the same issues. But every neighborhood in the district's got a whole different set of issues, and they have to be dealt with that way. And we just need to learn to work together and respect each other. I keep saying respect because that's part of being, I say I am pro District 1 because I believe that we need to respect everyone's property and their individual rights.
Ms. Macklin.
Now, you know Greg Fisher is not compassionate. For District 1, we are the stepchildren of Metro. And that's the whole district. It's not just the West, it's the South. You can dump anything, you can do anything in the South, and in the West, they just let us run wild. And Greg Fisher does not really take an interest. He has a few things that are pop up, like the new grocery store or something like that. But to really take an interest in that, he does not. So that's because we poor folk. So since we're in District 1, we don't get a lot of the things that they get in the other districts.
Councilwoman Scott, this issue has been brought up at least twice now that I've heard. I did take a look at the campaign finance records. You've raised just over $18,000 and far more than your opponents, about five times more than both of your opponents who have raised about $3,000 each. Most of those contributions come from outside the district, however. Should constituents be worried at all or concerned at all that your influence lies outside the district?
No, they should not, because I did fundraising for a living for more than a decade, so I know how to raise money.
Some of those contributions, as Mr. Coulson mentioned, they come from, I believe, $1,000 from Council President Jim King, another contribution, about a $500 contribution from his wife, and some other staff workers at King Southern Bank, which is Mr. King's bank. What is your relationship with President King?
We serve on Metro Council together.
But, I mean, is there any sort of, I guess, political agreement between the two of you at all whatsoever?
No, there's not. And if somebody thinks that $1,500 is enough to buy me, they are out of their minds.
Mr. Coulson, you alluded to this earlier. And when I talked to you before, you said that no one should be giving money to any candidate outside of the district. Why do you hold that position?
Because contrary to belief, I believe that whenever you accept money, then there is a sense of obligation and you owe a favor. I don't care if it's $500, $1,500, $5,000. There's a sense of obligation. These people are going to come back to you. Now, sure, you can say no, but if you're a fundraiser, if you're a campaigner, you want to try to please the people who are giving you money, and you're going to give consideration to what they're saying. I think it's very important that, you know, if you raise money in District 1, because that's where your job is going to be. You know, I personally don't want to be represented by District 10-1.
This question, I guess, since you brought up the issue of money, this has been in the news for District 1 as of late. There are five candidates obviously running for this seat. Only four of you are here or could attend tonight's debate. And one of your opponents, Ray Barker, he accepted a $1,000 contribution.
I object to that. I'm in the audience. And if you're going to speak on me, have to give me a microphone.
Technically speaking, ladies and gentlemen, we did invite Mr. Barker to this debate.
And I couldn't make it. I had to break the whole talk.
So he had to break the debate. So he couldn't initially attend.
No, all right.
But as I predicted, he is here. So we should note that. But let me just ask the question. He's accepted this $1,000 contribution from anti-gay activist Dr. Frank Simon. Mr. Colston, this first question is to you. You were saying that money comes with certain agreement. Should Mr. Barker return the funds?
That's up to Mr. Barker, just like it would be up to Attica Scott to return funds she got from outside of the district. You know, I'm not going to speak for Mr. Barker or for Ms. Scott. You know, I ask nobody for money. Okay, because I didn't want a sense of obligation going into the Metro Council seat. That was by choice. If I lose this election by choice because I can't put out postcards, I can't put out yard signs, I can't do that, then that's the people's choice. You know, you're going to get what you pay for.
Councilman Scott, we've already asked your opinion on this. It's publicly known what you're calling for. You've asked for Mr. Barker to return the funds. However, he and his campaign have raised the point that you are endorsed by CFAIR, which is the Fairness Campaign's Political Action Committee. Are you simply just reacting this way because it's a special interest group that is supporting your campaign?
No, Mr. Simon is part of a group that has been deemed a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And as an African-American, that's unacceptable to me.
Ms. Macklin, this question to you. How do you feel about the contributions, not only from Mr. Barker, from Dr. Simon, but Councilman Scott, from Councilman King and others outside of the district?
This is their business. I don't have anything to do with it, how they use the money. I don't think that it's going to have an effect on the vote. It's just that they're going to be able to put out more yard signs and more cards. So I'm just, you know, we could debate this all day long, but that's their business.
So do you believe that in politics, as the issue has come up with Citizens United, and I think everyone who's in politics knows that money is a part of it, do you believe that Mr. Colston believes that money somehow does influence candidates one way or the other?
Yes, of course. I mean, if Jim King give me $1,000, I think he's going to want a favor. But that's my thought. But, you know, most of my campaign is two people's money, Clarence Ellery and Rosa Macklin. So I didn't get that $1,000. But I'm not saying that I wouldn't take it.
Ms. Carter Miller, the question to you, whether it's Mr. Barker receiving the money from Frank Simon or Councilwoman Scott receiving a hefty amount of contributions from outside of the district, does money influence politicians in any sort of way, in your opinion?
Oh, there's always the off chance that it could. I'm in total agreement with Ms. Macklin that I think it's an individual choice. It's how you, perception is something that everyone has to deal with. Someone gives you money, how it's perceived by your constituents. Perception is a powerful tool. But I also believe that it's not so much that Mr. King would want a favor. I think that it would be Mr. King would feel like, well, that he's in control of you. And I am not the person that is looking to, that anybody's going to be in control of me at all.
Ms. Macklin, when I talked to you earlier this week, you said that you believe that Mr. Barker needs to sort of explain his views further on issues like fairness and other matters of that nature. Do you still believe that now, or do you believe that the matter sort of is behind us?
Philip, I think I said to you, you asked me, you know, I got a memory like an elephant.
It's quoted.
Okay. if it was going to affect the constituents in District 1. And I said it might affect some of them. But I don't think it's going to be a big game player in this, a game stopper.
As a final question on this round, how many of you would have voted for the fairness ordinance if it were up and you were in office? We'll start with Ms. Carter Miller.
The fairness ordinance. This is the...
The fairness ordinance being the law that was passed in 1999 by the Board of Aldermen that was reauthorized by the Metro Council in 2004 that provides basic protections in employment, public accommodations for gay, lesbian, transgendered, and bisexual residents.
I would have voted for it.
Ms. Macklin?
I would have voted for it.
Councilman Scott?
I actually spoke in support of it in 2004, and I would have voted for it.
Mr. Colston?
As I told you the other day, I really hate to comment on something unless I read the whole ordinance. However, if it's a matter simply of, you know, treating people fairly, you know, I would be in favor of that. You know, I don't care about race, religion, political views. You know, if you're Catholic and I'm Baptist, that stuff don't bother me. Treat everybody fairly. That's what I'm in favor of.
This question is for Colston, Macklin, and Carter Miller. Councilwoman Scott has now been in office for 7 months. What makes you more qualified to take that role? And we'll start with Carter Miller.
I believe I bring a unique skill set to that position. I am a people person. I have a way with dealing with people. I have a vision. I have plans. I have ideas. I know how to go into the community. I'm not trying to be a seasoned politician. I want to represent the people. And I think you have to have a closeness and a connection to the people. Not saying that Miss Attica does not have that connection, but I think I have a different set of skills that give me a different type of connection. I am a people person, aside from being the substitute teacher. The community knows me as a entertainer for years, and my art is to be able to communicate with people. I think that I can sit on the council and speak for the people and not be having attachments to any group or under anybody's thumb where they can tell me or dictate to me what I need to do, because I'm going to do what I think is best for the people, and that's what I think is makes me different.
Ms. Macklin?
Well, I have a couple of checkoff points. Okay, I worked in Rubbertown for 34 years. We're going to check that off. I've been a single parent. We're going to check that off. You know, I have done a lot of different things. I'm going to check off retirement, too, because this is shown as a part-time position, but it's really a full-time position to be able to get out and talk to 27,000 people. Is a full-time position to be able to manage that. So I'm going to check that off. But the other thing is that I've done a lot of things and been a lot of places. I have my own business. I really get in there. I'm a rebel. Does that sound like John McCain or somebody? But no, he was a maverick.
That was Maverick.
Okay, that too. But I've been out there in the trenches and fighting. I fought with Reverend Coleman with the getting the black employees their money. And so I know what it takes to make this tick, to make it right. I've always been the only woman or the first woman or something. So I'm a fighter. And I know that that's going to can take me so many different places. So that's why I think that I would be the best choice.
Mr. Colston.
What I'm saying is look how I approached this election. I went to door to door myself. I didn't have someone do it for me. I didn't do a drop and run. If I knocked on a door and nobody answered, I left them a personal note. My goal was to hit every voting Democrat in the district. I still have a lot to do. I was the only one in the group that responded to the Kentuckians for the Commonwealth Survey. You know, we live in a district where we have a lot of problems with air quality and pollution, yet nobody else responded to that. I was the only one who participated in all four of the debates and forums. That tells me I'm the only one who cared enough to try to reach every group in the district. I've been connected to the northern part for a long time. My two oldest kids went to John F. Kennedy Montessori when that neighborhood was not a nice neighborhood. You know, I worked for LG&E in the western part of the district for years. I've been connected a long time. I live in the southern part of the district. I'm connected to them, too, you know. And the one thing that I would do, while there are some events coming up, one of the things that I heard from people who used to be in Blackwell's district is how he used to sponsor trips on the Spirit of Jefferson and things like that. You know, that's one of the things that I'm going to attempt to do myself when I'm put in office is to hold events for District 1 people.
We have closing statements coming up, so if you have any other thoughts, you can include them there. We have more questions, but we're going to have to end on this one. Part of the city's ongoing budget woes is an imbalance between cost and revenue. How would you handle this? Councilman Jerry Miller says this is due to, in large part, to the cost of Metro employees' benefits. Any thoughts on reforming that system? And Ms. Scott, we'll start with you.
As someone who has fought for economic justice and human rights for years, when we start talking about benefits, which is often an incentive for employees to stay at low-wage jobs, jobs where they have to apply for social services, I get nervous about cutting employee benefits. And I believe that there are other ways in which we can look at raising revenue. We haven't raised taxes in decades, literally. So we have to look at other options.
Ms. Macklin?
Well, I'm not for raising any taxes. What I'm for is for the mayor and the Metro Council to spend the money wisely. Instead of cutting people, cutting jobs, we need to get into the Metro and all those duplicated services that we have, and that's who you know and not what you know. People are hiring family members and all that extra stuff, and we don't need. I think that we have enough revenue to run this city without cutting jobs, cutting benefits. Now, there's certain things we have to look at, you know, as far as that overtime thing. But I think we have the revenue here. We just have to use it a little bit more wisely.
I must tell you, I learned about one situation as far as revenue generating in the city, is that the city deeded over the property at Churchill Downs has been deeded to the city, where there are no taxes that come from the revenues that are generated at Churchill Downs. Now, to me, that's ludicrous. All the money that they make, even if it's just on that one day. But I think that's something that should be looked into again. I don't think that's that corporate, when you say corporate welfare, that whole situation. You're going to give them a break, but we got to carry the weight. You know, let them carry some of this weight, because the city could be flourishing if it receives some of the revenues that are generated or the taxes that they would pay. They don't pay any taxes. They pay no taxes.
Before we go into closing statements, Gabe, any questions from the audience you want to read?
Did I get a chance to answer that last question?
Oh. I believe.
Yes.
You did. You didn't.
No, I didn't.
No.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
Okay.
Confusion.
With regards to the budget, you know, I believe that Mr. Fisher was kind of handed, you know, a heavy hand from Mr. Abramson. We, you know, there was a lot of things going on from his administration that Mayor Fisher had to take care of. You know, I think the mayors, you know, take the job creation to the next level has some real possibilities to bring in some good revenue. You know, if that works, you know, that's going to be a major plus, and I can guarantee you I will want to be a part of it. You know, My biggest concern with his budget is when he's talking about items like overtime and pension and health care. To me, it looks like the working man is going to take a major hit in this. And I find that to be a problem, you know, especially when we look at some of the expenses that's going on within our own metro government. I mean, we have some legislative aides making almost twice what the council person does. You know, we have some directors making more than what the mayor does. You know, I'm not in favor of taxes. I'm not going to raise. You know, the economy's hard enough. Taxes is not the answer. But I think what we need to do is we need to look inside first and adjust inside and see how much money. And that would even include, to some degree, discretionary spending.
I wanted to rebut something that Mr. Colston
said
earlier.
Minute.
That he had attended, was the only person that had attended all four debates. I beg to differ. I was there with you, my dear.
Gabe?
Yes, this question is for all candidates. Many of the issues facing our city are not problems that can be addressed solely by individual council members. How are you now, or how do you plan to build relationships with other council members to address the issues and create solutions together?
And to speed things up, just try to make these under a minute. Mr. Colston?
Well, I think sitting here tonight, I don't think I will have made many friends on the Metro Council. But again, that's not really a concern of mine. You know, my concern is representing District 1. That is, in my opinion, what that person does. Now, don't get me wrong. Not every person on the council is going to hate me for some things I've said tonight. You know, some people may even be glad that I said them. You know, there's going to be people who's going to be willing to talk to me, you know, some who won't. You know, you deal with that when it comes. You know, and you make the best of a bad situation.
Councilman?
Well, you definitely have to, as with any job, work with your colleagues. And that's what I've been doing for the past 7 months, is working with my colleagues on committee within the Metro Council as a whole.
Ms. Macklin?
I have to agree with that. You are going to have to work with the other 26 or 25 people that's on the council. To get anything done, we have to be a cohesive group. And whether we disagree or whatever, we still have to work together, because District 1's going to need some of them other 25 districts' money to help us get over.
Ms. Carter Miller?
I am definitely, I played sports, so I know about being a team player. I want to be a team player, but I will tell you that I have my own, my agenda will be District 1 first and foremost. And the people of District 1, in as far as the future of the city goes, District 1 would be my priority.
Gabe.
This question is also directed to all candidates. Are you committed to community leadership after the primary, and will you support the winner?
Ms. Macklin, start with you.
What was the last thing he said?
Would you support the winner of this race?
The winner.
If it doesn't happen to be you.
Oh, yes, I have to support the winner, because District 1 can't, it will not be able to move forward if we're going to still remain fighting among each other. We have got to support each other, no matter who wins the race, because I got some ideas, and I think that they're great ideas, and I can make them happen.
Mr. Colston?
If I'm not the one elected, yes, will I support the person who is put in office? Yes, I will. They may not want my support, but they're still going to hear from me regardless.
Ms. Carter Miller?
I think that if there was a grassroots group to be of support to whoever wins, that these people that have been out working in the community would be that group to be to form that relationship with.
Councilwoman Scott?
Yes, at our last forum at the West End School, we actually had someone come up to us at the end and ask, when this is over, will you all work together? And my answer was yes.
Well, if we could just have closing statements, please keep those to 2 minutes, and we'll start with Ms. Carter Miller.
My name is Janice Carter Miller. I am the wife of Minister Jack Miller. I decided to run because I felt it was my responsibility. I was raised in District 1. I went to Shawnee, graduated from Kentucky State University. I'm a product of District 1.
I attended after-school programs with Miss Anita Moore Neal. I became Miss Exposition. I had all the foundation that I needed to make me who I am today by growing up in District 1. My platform is that I am pro-District 1. I am for, in favor of everything about uplifting, bringing back the pride, bringing back an economic base, giving us the tools that we need, repairing the community, to reach out and develop relationships between the young and the old, relationships between the West and the Southwest, relationships between the corporate community and each and every neighborhood in District 1. I look forward to the opportunity to serve the people. I will stand up and fight. I have no fear. I am fearless. I want to uplift our community because we've gone through a period where our morale is low. I want to be the voice of the community. I want to stand up and speak out and fight for District 1 to make it first.
Ms. Macklin.
I got into this race because I've always been a fighter, but I kind of got comfortable where I was sitting because nothing was bothering me and nothing was in my way. So when I was given the call, and you know where the call comes from, when I was given that call, then I had to stand up. And that's what my campaign is about, people standing up. And for those who have more, more is required. So more is required of me to do the best that I can do and to help the community, to use my talents and the skills that were God-given to be used to uplift this community. So that's why I'm in this race.
Councilwoman Scott.
I am honored to represent District 1 on Metro Council. I am chair, of course, vice chair of the Vacant Property Committee. I serve on Labor and Economic Development and Sustainability, and I would be honored to have the vote of District 1 on Tuesday, May 22nd.
Mr. Colston.
I am Steve Colston, and I am running for the 1st District Metro Council seat. My promise, when I'm elected, I will be somebody who will be completely honest with members in our district. You know, we're not going to have things like the Rubbertown Economic Project that nobody knows about. You know, we're not going to have an area like down in Lake Dreamland where, you know, people, a great area to live, where people have houses, but they can't repair their houses because of ordinances and regulations, because they live in flood zones and things like that. And what happens is a house falls apart, and then the people leave, and then the city takes it over by eminent domain. You know, those are all things that are done wrong. You know, I'm going to be looking at vacant and abandoned property, but I'm not going to be looking at it by raising taxes. You know, that is not the answer to me. To get this stuff done. It's also important to realize that District 1 is not a dumping ground. We have a right to a clean, healthy, and safe environment, and that'll be another chief goal of mine. I will work diligently to make sure that the appearance of vacant and abandoned properties is maintained. You know, if fair state laws and nothing's been done, I'll propose the legislation in Frankfort to try to get it changed. I'll talk with our attorneys to find out what we can do to get this done. You know, it's easy to talk about. It's harder to do. I'm going to do it. And I respectfully request your vote on May 22nd.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. I'm Philip Bailey with WFPL. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you for having me.
Give your friend a cheer and dress.